There we go.
And convene. We're at item 6A, public hearing. So for those of you in the public, with regard to commenting, I have public comments up here. If you're going to make a public comment, there are blue cards over here that you need to fill out. For those of you online, you have the instruction with regard to how to raise your hand. You might do it early so that, because sometimes there's a bit of a delay. I would ask that those in the audience would refrain from being vocal during a presentation by whoever, whether it's public comment staff or the appellant. So with that, we will open the public hearing for an appeal filed by Chris Maroney on the decision of the Siskiyou County Planning Commission re Golden Eagle Charter School located at 1030 W.A. Barr Road, Mount Shasta, APN 036-230-361. And with that, I'm also using resolution 03-92 for public hearing, so that if there's any question with that, that's where I'm using the protocol from. So with that, we're at item C on that protocol for staff report. Good morning.
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
So we want to do reading of the order of presentation into the record. That's the next step, because we've opened the public
hearing. Isn't that what I just did with regard to A?
I had foreseen that maybe you would go through the steps.
Oh, you mean on the A, B, C, D? Mm-hmm. Okay, got you. All right, sorry. Thank you, counsel. So the steps are the opening of the hearing by the chairman. A, B is the reading of the order of presentation into the record. C will be presentation of the staff report. D will be presentation of correspondence, which correspondence may be read, circulated, or acknowledged and made part of the record. E is presentation of reports, arguments, or evidence by staff of other county departments or public agencies. F is the proponent's arguments and or evidence. G will be opponent's arguments and or evidence. And for clarification, I guess I'll in a proponent would be in support of the appeal, and a opponent would be someone not in support of the appeal. We're in agreement there. H would be public comment, and we'll limit public comment to 3 minutes per each. I will be rebuttal by proponents. J will be rebuttal by opponents. And K will be close of the hearing, discussion by board members after that, and entertainment of a motion and second, discussion of the question and decision. And I failed to begin with, counsel, if you would just kind of tee up this, kind of a summary, because this is an appeal from an individual. It's not board action per se, even though this is being heard by the board.
Correct. So on the agenda, it appears as a Board of Supervisors item, because when the appeal request comes in from a member of the public, as it has here, the Board of Supervisors sets the public hearing date to hear the matter. This appeal is a de novo hearing, which means the board is hearing the matter of the use permit anew, and it's also considering the addendum to the mitigated negative declaration anew. So in this regard, it's a complete redo.
Thank you. So we have opened the hearing. We've read the order of the presentation into the record, and now we're at staff report.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning, Board. Haley Lane, Planning Director. So as you all know, we are here today to discuss the Golden Eagle Charter School Use Permit Appeal Hearing. Next slide. The project site is located at 1030 W.A. Bard Road in Mount Shasta, APN 036-230-361. The zoning of the parcel is neighborhood commercial and single-family residential, which I will discuss in later slides. Next slide. The project description of the project includes rescinding the existing use permit UP-96-03 and creating a new use permit UP-23-08 to include allowance of an existing school with an increase in school capacity from 60 students to 225 students and 35 staff. The proposal also includes a new 28,300 square foot building and a 960 square foot modular building. There is an existing 8,150 square foot building and an existing 1,920 square foot modular classroom on the property. In addition, the project will abandon the existing on-site septic system and connect to the Lake Siskiyou Mutual Water Company system. And we already have a well served letter from that agency. Next slide. This was the site plan that was approved at the Planning Commission hearing in February. And so on the slide right here is the existing structures as well as the proposed structures. As you can see, so as part of the Planning Commission hearing, a request from the commission was to extend and widen the driveway, which was included in this site plan. I will note that before that request, the site already met 4290 standards and, you know, our ingress and egress standards. But this was an ask of the commission in order to, you know, ensure there was an evacuation or things like that that, you know, that would be in place on site. Next slide. So the project is consistent with our zoning and our general plan. So as you can see, it's dual zoned neighborhood commercial and res one, and both allow for the operation of a school subject to a CUP. Next slide. There are previous project approvals with this site. So UP-94-15 allowed to place a portable building and compacted pad for classrooms, and UP-96-03 allowed for a private school facility up to 60 students in conjunction with an existing church per section 10-6.4203C. A condition of approval of the 1996 use permit was that in the event church operations cease, the school operations also miss seats, which is a big reason why we're here today, considering that the, you know, school operation is ceasing as part of this project. Or sorry, the church operation is ceasing. Next slide. Permit occupancy. So the current approved occupancy is actually a bit higher than what the proposed occupancy is, and that's because they're removing the church operation. And so currently, 250 people max for the church operation, 60 for the school, so that's a total of 310. And so with the removal of the church operation, the proposal is 260 total with the 225 staff, 225 students and 30 staff members. Next slide. And so when we received this application, considering that there is already an approved mitigated negative declaration, we required some technical studies be submitted as part of the application because as staff we wanted to determine whether or not an additional MND or other, you know, CEQA environmental document was required. And so we required a biological study, a traffic study, and a noise study be conducted because we felt that those were the potential impacts, you know, and so we wanted to determine if that would trigger an MND or an EIR or a supplemental of those documents. And so a biological study was conducted by NPLAN, and within the study they found that there are no significant impacts to biological resources on site. So there were no federally listed or candidate plant species as potentially being affected by the proposed project, and there were no special status plant or animal species that were observed during the biological survey, nor are any expected to be present. There were wetlands, other waters, and sensitive riparian habitat that were present on site, primarily along the northern and western site boundaries, but there's no development near that, and there's no proposed development near that. Next slide. Noise analysis. So a noise assessment determined that the noise impact was the same. So the study concluded that off-site noise levels, which include drop-off and pick-up times and employees driving to and from work, is considered a less than significant increase in DNL. Off-site circulation and parking lot noise is considered to be less than significant. Because noise exposure from a project playground activities is predicted to be satisfactory relative to the Siskiyou County noise standards, and because the project would not result in a substantial increase in noise levels at the nearest residences to the project site, this impact is defined as being less than significant. The study also noted that the construction activities are not significant. Next slide. The transportation impact study that was conducted noted that this project would not create any significant impacts to the project site. So the project would not make any changes to any existing public transit system or services or conflict with any public transit plans or programs. The project would not conflict with any roadway programs, long-range planning, or vehicle circulation policies. Traffic operations, level of service, and delay are no longer considered environmental impacts under the current CEQA guidelines. The project would not conflict with any multimodal, which is bicycle or pedestrian transportation programs or plans, or impact any existing multimodal facilities. There is adequate existing public infrastructure available to serve the local area and project, and to our knowledge, the site is not within an environmentally sensitive area, as the project site is already developed. The project is therefore exempt from the VMT analysis. Lead agencies can consider increasing, any varied school options and new locations as a potential measure to reduce VMT. With this understanding, existing and former use, student count, and building size are not critical factors in determining potential VMT impacts, since providing increased access of schools is deemed as a VMT benefit. The initial evaluation of the existing access routes to the project does not indicate any incompatible uses or unusual conditions, and the project will not introduce features significantly affecting safety. Any modifications at the project driveway will be in accordance with municipal code standards in 4290. The project will provide adequate emergency access standards per county and fire code standards. Next slide. So throughout this process, we've received a number of public comments, both in support and against or in opposition of the project. And so some of the supporting comments noted that the approval of the school expansion would provide community benefits, educational benefits, school growth potential, the ability to keep your children of all ages at one school site, would improve school operations, and you know, some viewed it as a minimal change in use since there's already a school operating on the property. Next slide. Again, a number of opposition comments that are summarized here. You know, folks mentioned concern with circulation and traffic with the increase in the school occupancy. There was mention that the project hasn't been adequately analyzed under CEQA, which I will still continue on in the next few slides. There were concerns related to the public availability of documents. There were concerns related to the building construction, mainly for the 28,300 square foot building. There were concerns related to public safety, noise created by the students, and occupancy concerns. Next slide. So in these next few slides, I'm going to go over the formal submittal that was submitted by the appellant in the claims making, and then you know, discussing the staff analysis. So the first claim is that the present school is operating unlawfully because it is not being operated in conjunction with the church as the existing use permit requires. So a use permit becomes null and void if it's not used within 2 years following the date of approval. And that's also following a hearing before the Planning Commission to declare it was unused. And so the permit in this case is not null and void because it was used within the last 2 years of approval. A use permit may be revoked if any of the conditions of the permit are violated. Revocation is a discretionary action to be taken only after an opportunity to comply has been provided to the permit holder, and following a hearing before the Planning Commission to revoke the permit if the condition was not corrected. The permit holder has been actively working with county staff to resolve the situation by applying for a new use permit that does not require church operation on the premises. Initiating revocation proceedings while this matter is still pending would be counterproductive and contrary to the intent of Siskiyou County Code Section 10-6.1402. Next slide. claim to. The county did not publish the notice of the Planning Commission proceeding properly. Government Code Section 6000 defines a newspaper of general circulation as a newspaper published for the dissemination of local or telegraphic news and the intelligence of general character, which has a bona fide subscription list of paying subscribers and has been established, printed, and published at regular intervals in the state, county, or city where the publication, notice of publication, or official advertising is to be given or made for at least 1 year preceding the date of the publication, notice, or advertisement. So the Mount Shasta Herald newspaper is a newspaper based in the city of Mount Shasta. The notices provided in this newspaper are specific to the Mount Shasta area. The Siskiyou Daily News paper is a newspaper that covers all of Siskiyou County. Likewise, the notices provided in the newspaper are not specific to an area or a specific city, but on a countywide scale. When there are multiple newspapers that qualify as a newspaper of general circulation, Siskiyou County has the discretion to choose the most appropriate newspaper. The Planning Commission is a countywide commission because it is the jurisdiction of the county. It is in the best interest of the county to provide a notice in a newspaper that will cover not only the city of the project, but also on a countywide level, so members of the county are able to provide comment on the project, not just the residents that reside in the specific city the project will occur in. Next slide. Claim three, the Planning Commission violated CEQA because an addendum is not allowed. So if a project already has an approved M&D or EIR that will be modified, that proposed modification may trigger a need for an amended M&D or EIR. If the modification to the project will result in less than significant effects, that is appropriate to simply use an addendum to the existing document. It was not determined in the staff analysis nor from the Planning Commission's approval of the addendum that the present project has foreseeable significant impacts. As part of the hearing process, public comments as to whether an effect is significant must be credible and factually based, pursuant to CEQA Guidelines Section 15384, substantial evidence, which means enough relevant information and reasonable inferences from this information that a fair argument can be made to support a conclusion, even though other conclusions might also be reached. Whether a fair argument can be made that the project may have a significant effect on the environment is to be determined by examining the whole record before the lead agency. Argument, speculation, unsubstantiated opinion or narrative, evidence which is clearly erroneous or inaccurate, or evidence of social or economic impacts which do not contribute to or not caused by physical impacts on the environment does not constitute as substantial evidence. Additionally, substantial evidence shall include facts, reasonable assumptions, predicated upon facts, and expert opinions supported by facts. As part of this application, as I mentioned, biological, transportation, and noise studies were conducted, and the studies indicated that there were no significant environmental effects associated with the project, so staff concluded that a new MND was unnecessary, and additionally, the Planning Commission reasonably exercised its judgment in evaluating public comment received, and the vast majority were conclusory or argumentative. Next slide. Claim four, the Planning Commission violated the Brown Act by not allowing full public comment at the second hearing, which was the February Planning Commission hearing. So the project was first heard January 24th, 2024, at the Planning Commission, where full and open public comment was allowed at that time, and after all comment had been accommodated for anyone wishing to speak, the chair closed the public hearing and discussed the project with the commission. During the discussion portion of the public hearing protocol, the chair and commission asked questions of the project to staff and the consultants. Ultimately, the commission decided to continue the project to the next Planning Commission meeting scheduled for February 21st in order to allow for staff and the consultant team to clarify and or provide information on very specific items requested by the commission. During the February Planning Commission meeting, the chair did not reopen the public hearing generally, but did reopen to allow public comment on areas upon which new information was received. Under Government Code Section 54954.3A, where the public has been given an opportunity to speak on an item, the item need not to be reopened for public comment. To the extent additional information was received at the February hearing, public comment was reopened to the extent of the scope of the new information. Next slide. Claim five, the project violated CEQA because environmental effects were considered in an addendum to the previously existing M&D and other provisions of CEQA were procedurally violated i.e. the public should have been presented and been allowed to comment on the MND. The proposed project has a lower occupancy than what is currently permitted. The current permitted occupancy of this project is 310 persons, while the proposed occupancy is 260 persons. For the additional building, staff and the consultant team found that the building itself did not trigger any environmental additional environmental review. When evaluating the project, utilizing the Appendix G of the CEQA guidelines, the biological noise and traffic consultants all confirmed that the construction of the 28,300 square foot building would not create any significant impacts. The Planning Commission did not find any substantial evidence that the significant effect was presented to otherwise dictate the use of an MND or an EIR. Per CEQA requirements, the 30-day public review period only applies to environmental impact reports or negative declarations. This review period does not apply to addendums to existing negative declarations. According to Section 15164C, an addendum does not need to be circulated for public review, and the addendum can be instead attached to the final adopted negative declaration. Contrary to the appellant's claim that a speed reduction is a mitigation measure pursuant to CEQA requiring public review, there's no speed reduction contemplated for this location. This is a designated school zone. For school zones, when there is no speed limit posted, the prima facie speed limit is 25 miles an hour. And engineering and traffic surveys only required if the county intends to reduce the speed limit below 25 miles an hour. Section 10-6.5610 of the Siskiyou County Code requires a public assemblies, including churches, to have one parking space for every four seats. That section no longer applies to the project as the site is no longer being operated as a church. Instead, applicable law regarding school parking is found in Title 5 of 14030, titled Standards, Planning and Approval of School Facilities, and this project complies with that section. As to public comment, the project received full notice as required under the Brown Act and other pertinent notices for the proposed use permits, i.e. notifying the property owners within the 300-foot buffer. Otherwise, CEQA does not require an addendum to have a special or 30-day comment and review period. Next slide. Claim 6, transportation concerns were not fully addressed, including sidewalks and bike lanes, and that the city of Mount Shasta has a mobility plan that was not considered. So the county is not required to implement the city of Mount Shasta mobility plan, in which the plan is not extended to the county's jurisdiction. Next slide. Claim 7, the application indicated 325 students were being requested, yet the student count was sometimes identified as 225 in the planning documents. So the occupancy number presented to the Planning Commission and the public was 225 students and 35 staff, total of 260 people at any given time. The proposed maximum student count of 325 reflected in the application is no longer applicable. Next slide. Claim 8, certain conditions of the project, such as ingress, egress routes, signage, and warning lights for the road, a time frame for construction and fencing were major changes requiring an MND and not an addendum. So Public Works Director Tom Deeney, who is also the roads commissioner, testified at the hearing that he has full authority independent of the Planning Commission to post speed signs. It was determined and agreed upon that Public Works could install a 25 mile per hour sign that would be in effect when school is in session. For school zones, the prima facie speed limit is 25 miles an hour, and posting signage to inform of an already existing speed limit does not require a survey. The previously adopted MND determined that the project would not have any impact on transportation resources. And as mentioned, the transportation study determined that the project would not create any foreseeable significant impacts. Next slide. Claim 9, staff report for the February hearing had significant changes, but the public had only 3 days to review such changes. Pursuant to the Brown Act, agenda and staff report materials are always posted 72 hours prior to the meeting. There's no additional legal requirement to meet the agenda, to meet for the agenda and staff report materials. Next slide. Claim 10, the county provided no analysis to support a traffic speed reduction to 25 miles per hour with undefined sign locations. So as mentioned, the appellant is discussing two separate issues. A condition of approval is a condition to the applicant must meet prior to use permit issuance. However, a condition of approval is not to be conflated with CEQA requirements. It would first have to be shown that limiting hours of construction, providing a site map, ingress, egress routes, fencing, etc., were discussed mitigation measures of significant environmental effects. The imposition of a condition of approval on a project does not trigger the need for a mitigated declaration itself. Next slide. Claim 10, the issue of noise was not properly considered and the county's noise element of the general plan is out of date, no longer valid, and otherwise the project is inconsistent with noise level standards. The county has a complete and valid general plan and is authorized to issue conditional use permits. With the exception of the housing element, there's no legal requirement to regularly update the general plan. The Siskiyou County general plan noise element remains relevant and complies with state law. Until an element is updated, the current element remains in force. The noise standards established in the existing noise element follow noise standards currently used in California. These noise standards apply to dwellings, schools, playgrounds, and churches located in Siskiyou County, not just the area of WA Bar Road. There are additional letters from Paul Ballard, the noise consultant, dated July 17, 2023 and February 12, 2024. There's a few additional in the record to discuss the noise standard in further detail. The county is not required to have a noise ordinance in order to enforce noise standards when issuing conditional use permits. There are adequate remedies available for individuals affected by unwelcome noise. Health and Safety Code Section 46000F states that all Californians are entitled to a peaceful and quiet environment without the intrusion of noise, which may be hazardous to their health or welfare. Section 46001A through E authorizes a county to declare, prohibit, and abate nuisances related to noise and allows any person to privately file an action for relief against noise pollution. In appropriate cases, law enforcement may also be called to deal with unwelcome noise complaints. Next slide. So there were a number of concerns also submitted after, you know, the final appeal was submitted, and so I highlighted those there. Overwhelmingly, there were concerns related to, you know, the parking lot light poles, if there was going to be any new lighting, why wasn't that analyzed under CEQA, and at this time, the project was not, you know, no new lighting was proposed as part of this project, so there was nothing to evaluate with that. There was mention that the existing sign violates county code. We did not find that apparent. And there were concerns related to SB 743 compliance, which I believe is discussed in a memo from Headway Transportation. And there was mention that the project conflicts with local plans such as the Mount Shasta Mobility Plan and the county RTP. Again, we do not have jurisdiction over the city of Mount Shasta plans. And the project is compliant with the RTP. Next slide. So appeal process. So as the Board of Supervisors, there are different options for you all. And so the board can either uphold the Planning Commission's decision, reverse or modify the Planning Commission's decision, or refer the matter back to the Planning Commission with guidance as to considering any new information that raises a concern. So as to reaching a decision, the county code requires that the action of the board shall be by the affirmative vote of not less than the majority of its total membership. So that concludes my presentation. I do want to note that we do have the consultant team here from Golden Eagle, the project manager Nick Trover, as well as the noise and transportation consultants. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, we'll reserve that for a bit. All right, so we'll move to item D, the presentation of correspondence.
Okay. Ms. Wendy. So the clerk's office has received a lot of correspondence, and these were received prior to the original appeal hearing of 5-7, as well as up to last night. So we've received emails and or letters from Ben Wittstein, Hillary and John Connaughton, Rebecca and Craig Bohm, Christina Morrison, Susan Brown, Lacey Morrow, Meadow and Ian Fitton, Larry Stock, Mary Roach, Scott Greenlee, Anna McDowell, Dave Thino, Gary Nordell, Jessica Harms, Randy Martin, Megan Tracy, Donna Mathwig, Dale LaForest, Sandy Sullivan, Marita McIntyre / Angela Ramsey, Dale LaForest, another couple of letters. William Larson, Carrie Derry. Here's my other list. Marieke Anderson, Ann Marsh, there were three letters and or emails. Melanie Findling, Lee Benda, Carol Coho, Nathan Kunden, Andrew Marks, Diane Chakos, Brian Criswell, Hazel White, Megan Tracy, Dale LaForest, another two, Claire Carrie Clure, Dale LaForest, Carla Savardre, Shelley Blakely, Todd Carson, Ann Marsh, there were four emails, Jennifer and David Fleur, and Courtney Middleton, and last night we received an email, it looks like from a Nicholas Riddle, which was forwarded to the board, Dale LaForest, and in the mail, yesterday's mail, I was just given this by the clerk's office, a letter from Phil and Jan Smith. Unfortunately, this has not gone to the board yet, but I certainly can make copies for you.
Okay, and is that the only one that, everything else is in the record currently?
That has been forwarded to you,
yes,
or
right.
Will be eventually.
Okay. And I'll say yes to get the board a copy of that one that was received by mail.
Okay.
Okay.
I can do that.
Presentations of reports, arguments, or evidence by staff of other county departments or public agencies. Anyone in-house? Seeing none, any online?
Showing none online.
Seeing none online. All right, we are at item F, which is proponents, arguments, and or evidence for the appeal. Mr. Maroney. Good morning.
Good morning to you all. Thank you for hearing my objections to the proposed new building in addition to the Golden Eagle Charter School. Contrary to some earlier accusations, I submitted items last month, 5 days before the hearing, the same day the planning department submitted their evidence. As you all are aware, but for those not familiar with how our county government functions, there are established timelines, and both parties to the appeal have complied with them. I did not participate in the first two Planning Commission meetings, presuming that the impacts of such a large building would be thoroughly considered and evaluated. Being intimately familiar with the site and the neighborhood and reading the transcripts that included significant misinformation from the staff and the consultants might be changed. I'm not an attorney or a planning specialist, but I have had a 45-year career as a general engineering and building contractor, primarily in the public works sector. I have proposed and reviewed many projects, and during this time, having designed, planned, and constructed multiple projects for public agencies and municipalities as both the general contractor and as the owner. In addition to what you have there, too, I just wanted to say that typically on the other side of this discussion, being very careful about the impacts that my projects generate, so this is quite different for me to be arguing the opposition here. For multiple reasons, I feel this project deserves further review. I've also had the honor of serving as a trustee on the Mount Shasta Union School District Board for 4 years, the Mount Shasta Recreation Park District Board for 8 years, the Mount Shasta Trail Association for 18 years, and as a co-founder, and the North Coast Cooperative Board of Directors for 6 years. I have some sense of how public schools operate, how the public review process works, and the nuances of public service. I can also appreciate that these decisions can be complicated and sometimes difficult. Page 13 of the current staff report states, and I quote, no comments have been submitted against Golden Eagle Charter School use permit approval other than the appeal submitted by Chris Murray, unquote. This is not true now, and it was not true a month ago. Now, this morning, your planning director clarified that item. It looks like she changed it since the printing of her current staff report. I will acknowledge that. By my count, and according to the documents on the county website, there have been a minimum of 9 comments submitted in support of this appeal. For the last 32 years, I've lived about 1 mile north of the building site, and prior to that, I lived 3 years immediately north of the site. We raised 2 children at these locations, and we were and still are a biking and walking family that uses W.A. Bar Road frequently. Due to the multiple accidents and close calls on bikes, we eventually did not allow our kids to bike on that road, especially south of the intersection of W.A. Bar Road and Reno Avenue. I have witnessed far too many accidents at that intersection, and anyone who lives in that area can attest to the fact that it is the most popular place for the CHP to park and wait for people driving right through the stop signs at that intersection. I think it's reasonable to say that this is one of the most heavily traveled roads in the South County outside of interstate and state highways. Any person living in the vicinity could attest to the increase in traffic since 1996, primarily due to the popularity of the Lake Siskiyou Resort and the South Fork Drainage. While I'm not a traffic expert, I've worked with many in my career. My firsthand observations as a former neighbor and current cyclist there should not be casually dismissed as immaterial because, quote, relevant personal observations can constitute substantial evidence, unquote. That's directly from the 2004 appellate court, Ocean View Estates Homeowners Association versus Montecito Water District. Not that it's required for good judgment, but I wonder if any of you have personal experience of biking or walking along this stretch of road on a regular basis. I know Supervisor Valenzuela has, and it can be quite dangerous. There have been passionate comments, both pro and con, about charter schools. Whether a person supports, does not support, or is indifferent to charter schools has no bearing on this project. Your staff report also acknowledges the same thing on page 7, stating, quote, evidence of social or economic impacts which do not contribute or are not caused by physical impacts on the environment does not constitute substantial evidence, unquote. I agree those comments have no bearing on the environmental impacts. There have also been several comments about the allowed uses under CU zoning, such as shopping centers, car dealerships, grocery stores, all posing the argument that a school has significantly less impacts. This same comparison was also made in the staff report to minimize the possibility of impacts from a school in comparison to that. If the property was purchased for one of these uses, I'm certain the neighborhood would be in a total uproar, but these are allowed uses under that zone. The only impacts that are relevant are the physical impacts that such a building and its use have to the surrounding environments. Considering the other county projects in the city in recent years that required an MND, the Lake Siskiyou Resort, of course, was the IR. Under CEQA review, the only one that comes to mind is the Lake Siskiyou Trail in 1999 and later the Box Canyon Trail. This was for a 2 to 6 foot wide, 6 mile trail around an artificial lake, with 3/4 of it on existing sewer line road and the Sweeney Boss irrigation ditch. I was instrumental in the layout, design, and fundraising for the initial studies and later donating to the construction, all prior to the flood district agreeing to lead the project. As some of you may remember, I was a party to an out-of-court settlement with the flood district that compelled the flood district to, one, make the tennis courts public, not private, redirect timber receipts from the resort to the county, to relocate 3 chalets from the lakeside to across the street to allow the trail alignment along the lake shore, and to permanently preserve public access around the lake and along the Box Canyon Trail. This also prevented the county from being at risk of financial damages from the state for violating the public recreational access under the Davis-Grunsky Act that funded the construction of the project. The point being that all of this was done under environmental review, resulting in a mitigated negative declaration. I believe the impacts from traffic light and noise of that project pale in comparison to the proposed project. I hope some of you have had the opportunity to enjoy those trails. As your staff has stated in the report, as elected officials and through appointments to the Planning Commission, these bodies are responsible for the evaluation of public safety, health, and general welfare. I've attached photos of the site in my previous enclosures to you, taken 2 Wednesdays ago as of last week. One is showing the complete lack of shoulders along looking south, the other one looking north, and the third is some students playing with the ball 15 feet off the pavement in a 35-mile-an-hour zone. I also didn't see any adult supervision, unless the tallest person in that photo has his or her back turned away from the students is one of them. This is quite striking in comparison to the 2 regular public school campuses that are fully secured with fencing, locked gates, and doors of all entries at all hours of operation, and with parking areas clearly locked for all entry points to the building. What would happen if a student kicked a ball into the street and another student ran out to get it? I believe that's just an accident waiting to happen at any speed limit. Page 2 of the conditions of approval, paragraph 12, does require the school to install a, quote, security system to mitigate trespassing onto the property, unquote. This could simply be a photoelectric sensor, a fence of any height. Using the word mitigate allows other choices in fencing. Any fence could be trespassed around. Therefore, in the interest of student safety and security for the surrounding neighbors, a fencing plan should be required for the public to review. This should have the same requirements that all at all the property boundaries, including thick woodlands. Listening to the Planning Commission dialogue with school officials about fencing was more confusing than clarifying. It was clear the school has no intention of a full perimeter fence. Fence can be built anywhere. I've built many of them in impossible conditions and under any conditions, regardless of physical obstacles. I saw no conditions of approval addressing this impact. Concerning occupancy, page 4, table 1 of the staff report calculates the prior approved total occupancy to total 310, as demonstrated earlier in the slide, and the proposed total occupancy of 260. I'm not sure how this is representative of the actual use. The prior church and associated school operate on a limited basis, as acknowledged in the conditional use permit. Yet the proposed CUP would allow occupancy 7 days a week. How are these figures even comparable or relevant? Occupancy is also related to frequency of use in terms of how it contributes to the physical impacts of a building this size. Assuming the prior church was used 2 days per week and the school 5 days per week, the approximate impact was 800 users per week. Assuming the proposed use is 5 days per week only, which it will not be restricted to, the impact would be 1,300 users per week. Page 4, paragraph of the staff report states the proposed occupancy of UP2308 is lower than the approved occupancy of UP9603, since the proposed project will be eliminating church operations from the project site, unquote. A fair argument can be made that this computation is incorrect and not representative of the actual proposed use requiring further mitigation. Without further investigation into the physical impacts, many scenarios are possible. Is summer use allowed? Are weekend and evening uses allowed? Are these restrictions on operational hours, or are there any on operational hours? Can the school also rent the facilities for other uses, such as volleyball, basketball, certain ceremonies, which is a common practice for most public schools? How will all of this be monitored if these uses are restricted? The argument frequently used by staff and consultants is that the use by the school is limited so that it will not physically impact noise levels, light district disbursement, or pedestrian and bicycle safety. This is an invalid argument if these uses are not considered. Some would argue that this is not possible, but I only cite what has occurred for the last year on this very site without a proper conditional use permit in place. If the use permit is correct for the current uses, why isn't one being requested now? The use of a public school has been the same this last year. As a contractor and a developer, the clear message is to proceed without the correct permit and then ask for forgiveness later. Concerning public safety, paragraph 11, page 11 of the staff report states, quote, for purposes of CEQA, the traffic study by Headway Transportation was completed in April of 23, unquote. The next paragraph states that an updated study was completed in April of 23. The actual date of the second study is December 8th of 23, not April of 23. I could not find any information related to a traffic study, such as a car count, a line of sight studies, speed limit variability, lane width, shoulder width, or separation between pedestrians, cyclists, and vehicles. The first study used discussed a 960 square foot portable building and uses the exemption of less than 10,000 square feet for some of the rationale for exemption. The second report in December corrects this and updates the building size to 23,800 square feet used by the Planning Commission, but not the correct 28,300 feet later disclosed. The report states, page 3, paragraph 6, quote, CEQA provides a categorical exemption for existing facilities, including additions to existing structures up to 10,000 feet square feet. The proposed new building far exceeds this footage. On page 7 of the staff report of the Planning Commission's meeting, in the section titled Planning Response, states, quote, as a charter school serving the broader community, rather than a specified zone or district immediately adjacent to the school, travel to and from the school would be primarily by vehicle mode. The absence of sidewalks and marked bicycle lanes in the project area is not a significant concern related to this specific school operation, since few students would walk or bike to the school, even if those facilities were in place, unquote. This rationale is presumptuous and not enforceable. How can this be assumed, much less verified, at a later date? There is no proposed condition of use that restricts the school from later changing their entire model and allowing transportation of student population of up to 225 students and 30 size staff by any mode they want. They could walk, bike, take a bus, travel by private vehicle, or any means they want to. This is simply avoidance of the real issue by suggesting a scenario the county would have no future control of. More importantly, the Office of Planning and Research, quoted by Headway Transportation Technical, they quoted the Office of Planning and Research Technical Advisories. They state, quote, of land use projects, residential office and retail projects tend to have greatest influence on vehicle miles traveled. Schools are not mentioned in the VMT threshold discussion. Rather, schools are mentioned in Section 8. In short, lead agencies can consider increasing and varied school options in new locations as a potential measure to reduce vehicle miles traveled, unquote. How can this be when the traffic consultant acknowledges that travel to and from school will be primarily by vehicle mode? As different from regular public schools, the majority of the traffic will be by private vehicles, and the traffic consultant uses, in part, this rationale to dismiss the needs for crosswalks, a bike pedestrian lane, or wider shoulders. It appears to me that in comparison to regular public schools that use buses to transport most students, the school actually increased vehicle miles traveled, not reduce it. The physical impact due to increased vehicle miles traveled from the school will not conflict with the students or staff, but will instead conflict with the general public that utilizes WFR road for this purpose. Again, there is a fair argument to further analyze this physical impact. The traffic report also uses another rationale for exemption, stating this project will not conflict with any multimodal transportation programs or plans, therefore the project would have less than significant impact on bicycle pedestrian travel, unquote. The staff report dismisses the most recent Mount Shasta mobility plan due to the lack of jurisdiction of the city of Mount Shasta on county lands, though due to a lack of any recent information from the county and the stated interest by both the county and the city of Mount Shasta to cooperate on such matters, it should be considered as relevant. Interestingly, the staff report ignored my comments regarding the adopted 16 County 2021 Regional Transportation Plan until today. The plan states, quote, 16 County offers several recreational off-road biking and hiking trails and is striving to improve roadway, bicycle, and pedestrian access and safety. Constraints with bicycle and pedestrian facilities in the county include a transportation network that is not well connected or maintained, as well as long distances between destinations. The city of Waurika has an adopted bicycle and pedestrian master plan, and Mount Shasta is currently developing a citywide active transportation plan, unquote. It's clear that the county has the intent to cooperate with the city of Mount Shasta regarding common multimodal transportation plans. Most importantly, and contrary to both the staff report and the traffic study, this is directly in conflict with the county regional transportation plan. This should have been considered when the traffic study was done. Again, there is a fair argument that further consideration be given by a complete traffic study. In 2018, when Golden Eagle did hire a licensed traffic engineer for the proposed location on Pine Street, he estimated that a similar size building, which this is, would result in an increase in vehicle miles traveled, not fewer. I attached and flagged that in the prior report that I gave you. Now that Golden Eagle's hired a civil engineer, not a licensed traffic engineer, for the WA Bar road location, he has determined that there will be fewer miles, vehicle miles traveled. How could this possibly be when WA Bar road site is even further from the center of town, where the population is densest and would require greater travel distance? He also noted the distinct possibility that any problem with traffic flow inside the parking area, such as a bus stop to unload, could cause traffic to back up onto the street during periods of hot use. Under this scenario, this could cause vision impairment, making it dangerous to exit the parking lot. This is entirely possible at this location as well and merits further study. These are directly at the heart of the fair argument standard and require more review. Concerning lighting, I won't get into a long version there. I've earlier sent you my concerns about lighting, including the sign, which I don't believe anybody has measured that with a handle, light candle instrument. I don't think anybody really knows, but I would suggest that it is in conflict with Code Section 10.6.5.2.3. I also question the lack of any lighting plan for the parking areas at their proposed Pine Street location, usually using virtually the same building footprint and occupancy. The parking lot lighting is 4 to 8 times brighter than the recommended standards. How will the proposed parking lots be lit? Certainly the school will have the occupancy at times when lights will be necessary for both pedestrian and vehicle safety. If this is not the case, why did the previous location with essentially the same building have a detailed lighting plan by a licensed lighting designer? This can't simply be deferred to the building permit process, where the public would be denied the right to comment on physical impacts that could directly affect them. This provides another fair argument these physical impacts could be significant, and CEQA requires further review. Concerning noise, I previously submitted comments concerning the noise impact. I won't go over all those details again, just to say that the applicant's noise consultant, Baldwin Acoustical, acknowledged on April 30th of 24 that the noise study that the county relied upon was inadequate in not studying construction noise impacts. 2 months after the Planning Commission approved the project, he prepared a second report that predicted construction noise could expose neighborhood homes to noise levels of 70 decibels. That is strong evidence of a significant noise impact. Earlier measurements found existing daytime noise levels were 55 dB at the nearest home, the Mount Shasta Ranch B&B. That evidence identifies an increase in noise levels there during construction of 15 dBs. That in turn constitutes a fair argument of a significant noise impact because, as he wrote on page 7 of his earlier report, quote, any noise level increase greater than 5 dB is considered a significant impact. In summary, by recommending conditions of the project that may mitigate some impacts, the staff has acknowledged that some impacts may occur or do exist. These impacts are supported by substantial evidence from the public and some from the staff itself. Some examples are abandoning the septic system and connecting to a sewer line due to increased occupancy to protect water quality, to comply with fire safety requirements to reduce the greater fire risk that has occurred since 1996, to limit maximum school occupancy capacity, to 260 occupants from the prior approved 60 occupants, to limit the impact of traffic, safety, light, and noise, to limit construction hours to between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. to mitigate noise impacts to the nearby neighbors, and to limit the speed to 25 miles per hour without defining the area of the zone or the location of signposting to mitigate safety along the road. The staff maintains that there is no evidence that the proposed project would cause any new significant environmental harm. To quote the staff report, quote, the Planning Commission reasonably exercised its judgment in evaluating public comments received, the vast majority of which were simply conclusory or argument, unquote. This conclusion pertains to the information received prior to February 21st, but not addressed comments received since then. This implies that some of these comments, and possibly some of the comments since that date, do have evidence of physical impacts. The Planning Commission imposed some mitigation measures to reduce those impacts, labeling them as, quote, conditions. But an agency does not impose such measures out of some excess of caution, but rather legitimate reasons that may cause predictable harm. The staff has already provided evidence that this project will cause some new environmental impacts regarding traffic, safety, lighting, and noise. The staff attempts to justify the position to amend an existing negative declaration instead of recommending a new one by arguing that these conditions are not environmental mitigations when it writes, quote, the imposition of a conditional approval on a project does not trigger the need for a mitigated negative declaration itself. They reference the case of Protect the Telegraph Hill versus City and County of San Francisco, unquote. Reading the case, I found the court ruled, one, we conclude no review was necessary under CEQA because the project was categorically exempt from review and no unusual circumstances exist to override the exemption. Exemption basis, the project will have a significant effect on the environment. We also conclude the city permissibly approved a conditional use authorization for the project, unquote. I don't see how this case is applicable Golden Eagle is obviously not exempt from CEQA, and the staff clearly isn't suggesting that. San Francisco did not impose environmentally focused conditions like the Planning Commission and staff is recommending for this project, so I really don't see the relevancy. By recognizing the need for further reduction of speed in front of the school, the staff itself recognized the risk to public safety. CEQA requires that this issue be resolved before the project can be approved, not afterwards. This passes the responsibility of speed reduction to some future public works decision. The courts have made it clear that this approach to decide matters after public input is not legal. In 1988, the court decision Sandstrom versus County of Mendocino cleared this matter up by ruling, quote, while a fair argument of environmental impact must be based on substantial evidence, mechanical application of this rule would defeat the purpose of CEQA, where the local agency has failed to undertake an adequate initial study. The agency should not be allowed to hide behind its own failure to gather relevant data, unquote. The court also commented, the city's assertion that it could find no fair argument there would be any potentially significant environmental impact rests in part in its failure to undertake an inadequate environmental analysis, unquote. The Planning Commission's condition of approval number 15 states, quote, a 25-mile-an-hour sign shall be installed to the satisfaction of the Public Works Department, unquote. The public will not have the future opportunity, and that is exactly what the Sunstrom case prohibited. The staff report states, quote, a use permit becomes null and void if not used within 2 years following the date of approval, unquote. No one is claiming the use permit has not been used, but simply that it no longer exists for the school. Condition 10 of the Evangelical Free Church of Mount Shasta, UP 9603, states, quote, in the event church operations cease, school operations must also cease, unquote. It is clear to me the property was sold by the Evangelical Free Church of Mount Shasta in January of 23, and the church ceased operations sometime in 22. Therefore, the Associated School allowed under the CUP also ceased operations in 22. The use permit for the church is still valid, but the use permit for the school has not been valid since sometime in 2022. You can't amend a use permit for a church to allow for a use permit for a school. At that point in time, no conditional permit existed, and there's currently no conditional use permit to amend. I've read a lot of comments while reviewing this project. The one I like best is from Siskiyou County Senior Planner Rachel Jarrett to Nick Trover, the proponent's construction manager, project manager in July of 23. It reads, quote, once the application is submitted, our permit tech will send copies of your project out to all state and local agencies who might be interested in commenting on it. After all comments are received, we'll take a look at the potential environmental impact of the project as it relates to the California Environmental Quality Act. I expect that we will likely end up with a mitigated negative declaration, unquote. Though I understand this is not binding, this is the most reasonable comment I've read from a professional planning director working on the project. At the core of my appeal is whether substantial evidence has been brought forward using the fair argument standard to require further review under CEQA. While listening to an audio recording of the Planning Commission's meeting on February 21st, at minute 28, there's a conversation between Mr. Carroll, our assistant county counsel, and Commissioner Hart, and this is what I heard Mr. Carroll say, quote, yes, at this stage where we have a CEQA addendum and we don't have a mitigated negative declaration or EIR, the question can be, is there a fair argument, not whether, as you just said, Commissioner Hart, whether who's right or who's wrong or who has the better judgment doesn't matter. If there are two competing opinions, and one opinion is supported by fact and indicates there could be a significant environmental impact, and really the next stage is if there's a fair argument, then CEQA would normally dictate that we go to a mitigated negative declaration rather than an addendum. Mr. LaForce, letter comes in at the last minute after public hearings have been closed on an issue the Planning Commission didn't explicitly ask to be heard. So you know it's a little bit tricky, but you're generally correct. Where there's two competing arguments, then we normally go to a mitigated negative declaration or an EIR, unquote. This is not taken out of context, and it directly addresses my contention that there is substantial new evidence for a competing argument supported by fact that has been presented. In this case, I have brought forward facts and information that support a fair argument under CEQA to require a mitigated negative declaration at a minimum. The Planning Department claims that the 1996 MND remains relevant because the proposed project, quote, consists of only minor changes or additions, unquote. How can 28 years later a 28,300 square foot new building be considered a minor addition? Minor describes both changes and additions. Otherwise, an interpretation would allow a new building addition of any size whatsoever without further environmental review. When is it not considered minor? 50,000 square feet? 100,000 square feet? There seems to be an argument to that. All total, this proposal will encompass 38,370 square feet of building. For comparison, Mount Shasta Elementary School is approximately 36,000 square feet. Like regular public school of its size in the South County, it includes a completely secure and fenced campus, an identified safe route to school, widened shoulders, ADA-compliant drop curbs, crosswalks in both directions, and marked pedestrian and bike lanes. The most frequent comment I hear when questioning the requirements of a charter school is, quote, we're a public school as well, unquote. If this is the case, and as a recipient of taxpayers' funds, they should also be required to comply with the same public health and safety requirements. I respectfully request that this project be sent back to planning for further CEQA review. Thank you for your consideration.
Anything further, Mr. Merlin?
Mr. Chair, I do have a question.
Sure.
Shall we be accepting as evidence Mr. Maroney's document as well as the PowerPoint from planning?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
And it can be argument or evidence. And so we've written to the Commerce Department.
Thank you, Council. Through council, can there be other proponents with regard to this, or is it strictly Mr. Maroney?
I would consider it to be the opponent, Mr. Maroney.
Okay, thank you. Opponents, arguments, and or evidence. We'll come into that category. One second.
The opponents to the appeal, I assume, would be the project.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Nick Trover, project manager for Golden Eagle Charter School. I don't have a document to read off of. I figured I'd answer any questions or comments that were brought up during the proponent for the appeal. Just want to go over a few things. We've been acting in good faith to try to make this project happen. We originally started with the city of Mount Shasta, spent several years working with them on a site that was right across from the hospital. Through those years, we did numerous studies, as Mr. Maroney mentioned. Ultimately, the Planning Commission approved it. It was appealed. The City Council approved it. It went into litigation, and it was still held up during the litigation. The litigation was brought by Mr. LaForest. During that, he was one of the persons that has been quite prolific in their documentation that they're giving to you. During that, the judge found that Mr. LaForest was not a credible expert. Mr. LaForest has also been sanctioned by the state of Oregon, fined for presenting himself as an expert. He also presents himself as an associate of the Institute for Noise Control Engineers. I believe, I'm not sure if that was sent to the council, but you can look up on the Institute of Noise Control Engineers. He is not an associate. I actually called just to make sure he is not. So some of these things that are brought up in these comments are, you know, a reasonable argument. A reasonable argument can't be made between an expert and a non-expert. An expert is an expert in something. Somebody might have an opinion, and maybe at some point it does become valid, but we've gone, you know, above and beyond trying to provide expert opinions, information on you know, what impacts may occur because of this project. Fencing was brought up. We do have plans to fence the entire property. I don't know about the entire property, but on the whole section along the first front row. As we talked about in the Planning Commission, it is difficult to try to get to the back. There's a lot of trees and shrubs. Is anything possible? Of course, anything is possible. But our plan is to fence the front. There was also talk about the amount of students students and people coming in and going from the school versus church operations. Church operations go, you know, all year. So if you're using the math that Mr. Maroney presented, you're about in the same category as when you're in school for 35 weeks. So if you look at the yearly basis, maybe on a weekly basis, it's more for the school, but on a yearly basis, it's the same for the area. So I think we can look at that in two different ways. There is currently lighting on the site. That lighting is by use of a timer. I don't think there's any plan to add any new lighting at this point. If we did have to add new lighting or wanted to add new lighting, all lighting would have to match with California regulations. There are certain regulations that dictate how many lumens a light can disperse, and they have to be dimmed at certain times or without use. So we have to follow all the laws associated with anything that we plan to do. Ultimately, as well, we prefer to do this through the county, get county approval, work with the county on all these improvements, work with the Public Works Department on frontage, whatever we need to do to make this happen. Ultimately, we don't need to go through the county. We can go through the state and go through the Division of State Architect. That doesn't require any county approval or coordination. The only thing we need to do at that point is coordinate with the county on our access, which is already there. So if the school wanted to, we could go submit to the Division of State Architect, get plans approved through them, and build without any purview from the county. That's not ideal. It costs a lot more money to build through the Division of State Architect. We don't have as much flexibility as we'd like, so that's why we choose to go this direction. But ultimately, this project can still be built without any county approval or input. So again, that's not the direction we'd like to go, but ultimately, that is an option for Golden Eagle. So I think those are all the main comments I have right now, but I'm happy to answer any questions, and if there are questions that come up from the audience that need information, we're happy to engage. We also have our traffic engineer and our noise engineer. I don't know if you generally want to have anything to rebut. Okay, thank you.
Thank Good morning, Lauren Chilson, Headway Transportation. I'm the professional engineer that prepared the traffic analysis, and I'd like to hit just a couple points of that since it's been brought up. I think it's really important to understand why we did a reasonably basic traffic analysis instead of a full tilt comprehensive impact study. The reason is we have an existing MND in place. So the question is, does the change in use or occupancy, is there anything about that would trigger a new significant impact? It must be significant in order to trigger a new full-fledged document, right? So we complete an initial checklist. This is the process. So that's exactly what we did. Went through that process and identified that there was no impacts that would be significant, all less than significant. That's not to say that there is absolutely no impact, that there is absolutely no effect. That's not the case. But nothing that would be measured through thresholds that are established as significant. Okay? It's an important point. So just a few quick topics on that. Context is important in this case, too. The neighborhood commercial zone, existing school use, previous church use, and so what we're measuring against is that existing school use, not a new school that exists, right? Also very important in the context of understanding if any of these changes are significant, and measure against the threshold. So just a couple key points. Question has been brought up about what about the Mount Shasta Mobility Plan? Yes, we're aware of it. Yes, we reviewed it. The question is, does the project conflict with other plans? And the answer is no, it doesn't conflict with it. It doesn't introduce any new feature or do anything that would render that future project by others, not just a number maybe they can obtain funding through, would it enable that not to happen? Would it conflict with it? And the answer is no. This project's not building any walls, not narrowing the road, not doing anything to the frontage that would cause that to not be able to happen. It's not responsible to construct it. That's clear, but it's also not conflicting, and conflict is the key word there. Are there bikes, pedestrians? Yes, absolutely, but it's not in conflict, and that's important. I want to cover VMT very quickly. The appellant cited previous studies that said VMT could increase, and how could this one decrease? Very important to understand that in December of 2018, after that prior study, OPR, Governor's Office of Planning and Research, issued very clear directive on how to measure DMT. And in that, it cited that schools were part of potential mitigations or reductions. It did not establish criteria to evaluate them. It did not establish thresholds. It actually put them on the other side of the equation that said access to schools is beneficial potentially for DMT, not a deterrent. So that was new in 2018, and that's why that's been applied in this study. And this is based on fact from OPR on their guidance. Speed zones can be instituted by county public works. That's typically how it's done. That's exactly what they're doing. It's not a mitigation measure. It's at their discretion to do that. They chose to exercise that discretion. That does not make a mitigation measure. And then finally, I hate to even have to address this one, but my qualifications have been called. I'm a registered professional engineer in the state of California, have been since 2001, performed hundreds of impact studies, intersection designs, every kind of traffic analysis you could imagine. And in fact, it was my company that prepared the prior report that they have on sites. So I assure you I'm an expert in this topic. And I'm absolutely happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Good morning, Supervisors. For the record, my name is Paul Ballard. I'm the owner of Ballard Acoustical Consultants, and I've been preparing the noise analyses for these projects. I won't take up a lot of your time, but there are a few key points that I'd like to make. Lauren, the traffic consultant, just ended with qualifications, so I'd like to start with that. We've seen quite a few letters from Mr. LaForest claiming that the noise study is completely inadequate, that it was improperly prepared. I've been seeing this type of correspondence for years and becoming increasingly less professional to the point where in one of those recent letters he actually called me a liar, and I take great offense to that. So by way of qualifications, I've been doing one thing for 37 years since getting my degree in mechanical engineering, and that's working as a noise consultant. That's all I've done. I've authored thousands of noise studies. I'm a board certified member of the Institute of Noise Control Engineers, which is the highest level you can get to. You have to maintain that certification, your qualifications. I've guest lectured in university acoustics courses and recognized as an expert in California courts of law. So I take great exception to Mr. LaForest claiming that he's a member of the Institute of Noise Control Engineers. And as mentioned previously, I checked also, and there is no record of him on the membership list. He actually has that in his signature line. Just to close out on that topic, in the recent case of Mr. LaForest versus the city of Mount Shasta in the Golden Eagle Charter School in April of 2023, the judge specifically said it is uncertain what the petitioner's expert qualifications are for making opinions on noise. So I'll leave the qualifications aspect of that. Construction noise is a drone that he's been beating pretty loudly because when we did the original study, there was no new structures planned at the site. So the original noise study did not include an analysis of project construction noise. Subsequent to that, construction of new buildings have been proposed. We were asked by the county to take a look at it, and we did. We conducted an analysis, and we concluded that yes, during construction, people are going to hear construction noise. The nearest residences are hundreds of feet away. Construction noise is part and parcel if the county sends out a crew to repair a broken water line or what have you. There's noise that affects us on a day-to-day basis. No different here. The construction levels that we predict were below the levels recommended by the Federal Transit Administration for assessing impacts. They're well below levels that would cause damage to hearing. And so the question is, with respect to CEQA, are people really going to be impacted by this construction noise? And my professional opinion is no. The construction is going to occur during daytime hours. It's going to be of a finite duration. And so it's difficult to make an argument that people are really going to be adversely impacted by construction noise during the project construction. So that was my conclusion there. Um, A familiar refrain from Mr. LaForce, and I'm sure you're going to be hearing from him because he's here today, but is that the county general plan standards that we addressed are incorrect. And he's been making this argument on study after study, no matter what the project is in this area that we're working on, we're hearing the same argument. And the county has routinely rejected this argument. The county's general plan has been adopted, and we have appropriately addressed the noise standards contained within the county's general plan. He says there's all kinds of different offsets that should be applied. We applied the appropriate offsets. I won't go into the weeds, the technical weeds on that, but that has been addressed previously in correspondence from us that's in your packet. There's this recurring argument that an EIR would provide all this new information that you don't currently have access to. And from a noise standpoint, the requirements for preparing a noise study for an initial study are identical to the requirements for preparing a noise study for an EIR. There is no new information to be had by, you know, or some magic bullet by triggering an EIR. We've already done an EIR level analysis for the project and concluded that there wouldn't be any significant noise impacts. We recognize that it is an increase in the number of students on the site. We looked carefully at the neighbor's proximity. We did calculations in accordance with industry standards, and the thresholds for identification of a significant impact just weren't met. So, in conclusion, I feel like we've done an adequate, very thorough study that's in compliance with CEQA requirements, and I'm sitting right here, so if you have any questions following public testimony or at any time, I'd be happy to try and answer those for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else from the project consultant-wise? No? Okay. So we are at item.
Would it be okay to take a quick break before we get into the public comment?
Sure. Do you want to take 5 minutes?
Just, that's all.
Or just enough to break the...
About five.
5 minutes.
Yeah,
okay.
I'd like to get
so
up and move.
We're going to recess for 5 minutes before we go to public comment.